You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Round, round, get around, I get around,
yeah,
get around, round, round, I get around,
I get around.
/7:51 on a Monday, a little bit different on a Monday. On a Tuesday, a little bit different as the president spoke here right at the top of the show. So good morning to everybody. We're going to talk about the president's speech and then second episode of the PBS series, The Vietnam War, occurred last night. Somebody sent me a text message yesterday and said, hey, Mac, you know, the first five episodes are posted online. You can watch them. 1 through 5, if you're traveling or if you're so disposed. And I said, I'll watch one tonight, thank you. But joining me from the great state of Texas is Tim Lynch. He is the son of a Vietnam veteran, but before we talk about the PBS series, I want to talk about the president's speech at the UN. What did you think?
I liked it. It sounded very presidential, but he got in a little bit of that classic Trump with the rocket man's on a suicide risk. I like that even better. But standing there in the belly of the beast and calling those guys, on legitimate issues such as who's on the Human Rights Commission and who's paying for all this and lack of efficiency while they focus on process. These are legitimate claims that they've been stated before, but when they come from the president right in your face, I like hearing it.
Yeah, you know, it's almost like, you know, why have we've been so delicate, you know? What is wrong with walking in and saying, these are the things I think are wrong here. These are the things I think you do well. These are the things I think you could do better. It's like any other performance evaluation. That should be the way you do it, but rarely done, as the United States has accepted the status quo at the UN for a long, long time.
Right, we haven't, and they're not that efficient. They don't always do good. I mean, the one thing that keeps on coming back to me is Liberia. You know, where you had executive outcomes go in there, the Revolutionary United Front were the bad guys, and they were hacking off people's arms. I mean, they were horrible. The South African company goes in there and sorts them out in about 3 months, gets run out of there by the UN, who puts in another one of their African peacekeeping forces. Ruff comes back, the peacekeeping forces are raping and pillaging. I mean, the place descends into hell, but nobody says anything because there's no mercenaries in there who are making it better. You know, and that just bothers the hell out of me.
All right, so anything in the speech? Talk about the Truman and the Marshall Plan and its history and its roots in the United Nations. He emphasized interest in the United States first. I thought he would talk a little bit about the Paris Accord, and then he touched on that the United States would totally destroy North Korea and Rocket Man. You know, and again, what I'm sure that relative to North Korea, right? What he wants is he wants to be treated like Russia and like China. And to not be treated like them is what must drive him crazy. So there you go, a little dig at him. And then he transitioned to Iran, their chief outpost or export being terrorism and the support of terrorism around the world. I read an interesting article yesterday talking about Hezbollah fighters on the northern Lebanese border that are working with the Lebanese army to clean out Islamic State fighters in the area. And they were talking to the commander, and he said, the crescent has been reestablished from Iran through Iraq, he said, with the help of the Americans. And he said when Saddam was there, it was not possible. Now it is. And into Syria. And then he didn't say anything about Lebanon, and the article went on to say he smiled. So kind of an interesting little bit. And then he talked about Venezuela and Cuba, and then he finished up with kind of America first. There's nothing in there that struck me as anything more than a compilation of the issues he's dealt with and the statement he's already made. After he talked about terrorism, he talked about Venezuela and Cuba. And so, I mean, there was no surprises in there as far as I saw. Tim, did you hear any?
No, I didn't. But when he was very blunt about saying that socialism and communism in every place it's been tried has resulted in famine and just horrible conditions for the people of those countries, which is absolutely demonstrably true, I noticed that there wasn't that the applause level kind of died down and the chittering and chattering started. And I like that. You know, hey, I don't think we have any business in a military sense being involved in Venezuela. But you can't look at that country and not see what's happened. And as usual in any communist system, the people at the very top have got all kinds of money, all kinds of food, all kinds of privilege, and the regular people are just suffering. That's the nature of that particular system, which is why it's alarming that it's so positively portrayed on the college campuses today. You know why Antifa would have hammer and sickle banners while they're attacking quote Nazis is to me just ludicrous, because they clearly don't understand what those banners mean.
What'll be interesting, the major headline of the speech is that he's not the headline.
There you go.
Which doesn't have, and again, which I think would mean a little bit that maybe he's growing into the role. I don't know. And again, somebody we know and have worked for is part of that White House. We know, you know, kind of the way he would do it, which is it's going to be orderly. It's going to set him up to be successful. Our job is to provide him the information and the focus, and when he looks in a certain direction, make sure we're standing there with the appropriate tools for him to grab onto and to achieve his objectives. And so we're all in support of him. But it does seem like, you know, the president, and it's interesting, whether it be reaching out to Democrats, he seems to be, I hate to use the word hitting his stride, but he seems to be settling the role into the role of being president a little bit better. Is that me being a cheerleader? For instance, there wasn't any Twitter response to the Emmys.
Yeah, which I didn't know.
That's a good damn sign. Incredible restraint on his part, right?
Right.
So, anyway.
Well, you've got this this axis of adults, a term I saw coined, which I liked, which is Tillerson, Mattis, and Kelly. Right? Now, two of those three we know, and we know their modus operandi. We know what they're trying to achieve, and I think you just summed it up very well. In that they are, as they always have done through their career, setting up their boss for success, and doing it behind the scenes in a low key manner. But it's exactly what I would expect with two of the three of the axis of adults in such positions of prominence, and it's very encouraging to see.
Well, somebody sent me an email the other day, and said, you know, we know General Kelly. General Kelly's a funny guy. He's also got a quick wit. And when he chooses to use it to carve somebody up, it's relatively amusing, and can be tough. But the restraint he showed when whatever representative said that he was an embarrassment to the uniform, a disgrace to the uniform, I think is a great example for the president. Here's somebody calls you out like that personally, in public, and it echoes around the world, and he shows incredible restraint because he knows that he has a stronger hand, and he responds to it in a very dignified way and very measured way, and then he goes on to about it and doesn't make that guy anything more. He doesn't even mention him in his comments, by the way. So I thought it's just a good example for the president who doesn't roll like that.
No, he doesn't. And Gutierrez there has never spent a day in uniform. His comment was completely outside the pale. And Kelly, I think, in his measured response, highlighted that. I mean, it was an indefensible statement, and one of which I don't know if the guy's tried to backpedal or not. I don't pay any attention to the guy, but I think everybody that was paying attention was like, oh man, that was stupid, because it was. I mean, it was just completely indefensible.
What I didn't understand was it came, you know. Well, we'll get to that in a few minutes. You are okay. So, the bottom line with the president's speech, there's nothing new in it.
No,
nothing groundbreaking. And so you can watch it if you paid attention to different things he said in the past. He said nothing new today. So, he just said it in a different form. Okay, let's switch gears. Ken Burns is special. His documentary. That is two episodes in on PBS called The Vietnam War. You are the son of and the nephew of a Vietnam veteran. Have you watched it?
Oh yeah, I watch it and I'm intending to blog on it daily.
Okay, so tell everybody where they can find your blog.
It's Free Range International. Just all one word, Free Range International. It's the first thing that comes up.
Okay. All right. Free Range International, Tim Lynch, retired Marine Corps major. Talk to me about so your thoughts so far, two episodes in.
I see it as the intention was, according to the producers, that they were going to unpackage what we don't talk about and give this everybody a very fair and honest opinion of what's going on in the war. And what I see is the anti-war narrative writ large. What's particularly galling to me is some of the interviews with veterans. I've been listening to a lot of this Jordan Peterson, this professor from Canada who's prominent on the YouTube now after opposing the C-16 bill up in Canada, which mandated speech specific pronouns for people as law. Compelled speech as law is bad. But at any rate, he was talking to Joe Rogan once and it was fascinating. And he made an analogy about they were talking PTSD and Peterson said, you know, when for the warriors that are going into war, when they're facing that adversity, there's two modes to go. One is as a victim, the other one's as a predator. And of course it's preferable to be the predator because of the neurochemical pathways it opens up, and you know, then he starts explaining that and I get all confused. But I like the analogy. Because what we've seen, with the exception, with the sole exception so far of Carla Marlantis, are veterans relating to you from the predator, from the prey status, you know. And then last night, this guy, John Musgrave, opens up and he told a story that I don't believe. Okay, he's on an LP out in Kantian, for Christ's sake, right? On an LP.
Explain everybody Kantian.
Kantian was a fire base that was way up in the northern portion of Vietnam. It anchored what was known as Leatherneck Square, called Leatherneck Square because the Marines battled in there. And basically the purpose of those fire bases were to prevent massive movements of NVA battalion regiments down into the south, to try to force them to go through Laos and take the hard road where they got attrited by malaria and B-52s. And so there was a lot of fighting there. And I'm going to address more of that as this moves on. Now, let me ask you a question. We're talking LPs, listening posts, right? What's your understanding of the SOP, okay? You're out on a listening post. How's that work, as you recall?
They got a radio. I'm out there. Normally, it's me and at least one other Marine, and we are supposed to report the post, it could be every 15 minutes, it could be every, depending on the enemy situation, the interval might change. If the enemy is supposed to be close to us, we might have a 10 minute, you know, 15 minute interval. If he's not near us, it might be 30 minutes.
Right. And normally, as my understanding was, you might get a radio call every whatever the agreed interval is, and right. You respond with clicks in your handset, right? Two clicks means everything's fine, right? So this Spanish story is he's out there in Cantien, who's surrounded by NVA who are moving up towards the fire base. He gets his call, and I've heard variations where every hour you just click once, and if you have enemy around you, you click repeatedly twice and then blow your claymores and haul ass. But regardless, he says that they're calling him up, and he's not going to click twice because he's surrounded by enemy. So they think he's asleep, and they keep on calling him, and then it dawns on him that maybe the enemy's around him, and they ask, and then he clicks it once, and that to me is bullshit. I mean, the SOPs for LPs, because being on a listening post is hairy damn duty. I mean, that's you're out there, you're the sacrificial goat, and you're staked out there. And so not having a code, which took, in one line I recall, was three breaks of the squash because you didn't want them talking on a damn radio because it's loud. You don't want them talking to you.
Right.
But this guy goes on and on about how they had a talk, and then he gets that knowing look and goes, and then they figure out. I don't believe that for a friggin' second. And it's reinforcing this narrative that the NVA was this a powerful, tactically proficient, overwhelming own-the-night force, and we were just a bunch of schmucks who every time we left the wire and stumbled out, they grabbed us by the belt and beat the hell out of us. And I don't. That is not the story of Leavenworth Square. It's not the story of Vietnam veterans, and it really irritates the hell out of me. So that's just, and now we've covered the first 5 minutes.
Wow.
I mean, it really bothered me.
You know what? I didn't read that much into it. What I read was, and again, let me defend him. He's 18, 19 years old there.
Right.
Okay, so he's not a leader. He's a Marine out there and terrified. Maybe he's not a carnivore. Maybe he's finding that being a carnivore, while it may suit other people, it's not him. So maybe that's his personal experience.
I agree with all that. I've read the book. So Musgrave, this guy comes up over and over in the book.
Right,
he actually is kind of a warrior. My point being that the idea that an LP is out there and they've got no code for if in fact the enemy is walking right past him right in front of him, that there's no procedure or code for that. And the CP's got to play 20 questions with them back and forth is, to me, ridiculous.
Okay.
That's just ridiculous.
All right, but so the two Vietnam veterans I've spoken with both gave it high marks yesterday.
Yep. There you go.
And so I in fact, both of them replied, I wish I would have known some of that stuff before I went there relative to the history of the nation and how it got to be the way it was. They were both relatively humorous about that. Give me other thoughts on the series.
Okay, so the series then transitions into basically explaining how he got involved with Kennedy as president, Diem,
right.
The South Vietnamese president who ultimately was murdered in a coup, and it kind of ends where Kennedy is assassinated. Now, what it glosses over as it goes through this stuff is, you know, Kennedy has some bad experiences, and it talks about the Bay of Pigs, which was a fiasco, and it talks about the missile crisis, and then it just sort of mentions the Khrushchev Kennedy meeting in 1961.
Right.
But that meeting is where this all started. That meeting is exactly where it started, in Kennedy's own words. He said because he got so manhandled, so embarrassed, he was so outclassed, that the one place where he can confront these guys, the one shooting war we have in South Vietnam, and that was the trigger that started making overt assistance versus just a few advisors or whatnot. That was the trigger. And when you think about it, okay, now watch this. Watch me switch gears on you. Matt, did you know we're in the middle of an opioid crisis in this country?
I've seen that.
Yeah. It's bad, right? People abuse pills, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's horrible.
Right.
Kennedy, during that conference, was taking 15 different pills. He had Addison's disease. He had his back injury. He's taken Demerol. He's taken Ritalin. He's taken all kinds of drugs. Do you think maybe that might have had something to do with his disastrous performance? I mean, it's not examined in this thing. In Ken Burns,
that's a little bit deep as you limit the subject of Vietnam. And this is one of the things that I think is I'm sure was a challenge for them.
Yeah.
And that is, how do you limit? Let's just say every episode is 90 minutes. I think there's some that are a little bit that are 2 hours, but let's just say 90 minutes. So that's 15 hours total. How do I do Vietnam in 15 hours? Sounds like a lot, yes. But as you begin to develop it, we have the epilogue at the end. We have, you know, the build up, the history. So that takes three. There's four and a half. So there's a third of the program, getting into it in terms of the history and then the conclusion. All right. So that leaves us 10 hours to develop, the American domestic situation, the North Vietnamese domestic situation, the South Vietnamese domestic situation, and then the international scene that plays around it, the political scenes in each one of those countries, and then the military aspects from each one of those countries, all distinct and complex.
Right.
So to me, daunting in terms of, if you only want to focus, you could probably do 10 hours on the run up to Vietnam and cover the things you're talking about. But I don't why, whether his drugs, impacted his decision, making, is that germane to the greater story?
No. But what is also not germane is this portrayal of the Kennedy years as Camelot, which is not challenged at all in this thing. Like I said in the beginning.
Yeah, but I don't know I don't know that that's germane to Vietnam. To me, the thing that I was surprised that I didn't see much of is and I don't know when he's going to deal with it, but I know he has to, is a dysfunction at the JCS level. Now it begins when McNamara, and I'll tell you what, one of the things that's really creepy is that McNamara and Rumsfeld look a little bit alike.
And act a little bit alike
and took their nations down the same path a little bit alike.
Right.
It's creepy, honestly, to look at those two guys, to hear what they did, and it's a little bit uneasy when you watch that thing. So I'm curious when he'll get to the dysfunction and the out and out lies that happened, because you could do it back then, and we were not connected. So what went on on the other side of the planet tended to stay on the other side of the planet, and it wasn't truthful. What else about what you've seen now, are you biased against it going in? Because you sound like you are.
Yeah, well, I read the book. The companion book came out last week, and I spent about 4 days pouring through that thing just to try to get a sense of what it was going to be like. I didn't want to start out biased about it, but we go back to the Rumsfeld versus McNamara thing. Rumsfeld is not positively portrayed in today's press or today's history, and nor should he be.
Right.
But McNamara was identical in his contempt for the military, his conviction that he had all the answers, the implementation of strategies that were fatal to them. I mean, the reason the Marines were up in Leatherneck Square getting their asses handed to him was installing that McNamara line, which was stupid. But that's not in the book, and I suspect throughout this series, he's treated as part of the Camelot guys as a sympathetic figure. He's a smart guy, but then he kind of turns against the war. Wait a second, dude. You're the guy that set all these preconditions that you're all of a sudden turning against, and that's not addressed.
So in the book, is McNamara given a pass the way he's treated in the book?
Yes, yes, he absolutely is given a pass. And it, and again, if they were at the same time comparing and contrasting him to Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld wouldn't get a pass. The press hates Rumsfeld. I'm not too fond of him either, to be perfectly honest. And also, to be perfectly honest, and I pointed out in my post yesterday, you know, in 2003 when we went into Iraq, I was sort of for it. I didn't see a whole lot of problems there. In 2020 hindsight, I can see a ton of problems, you know, but I've got to be honest. At the time, I was for it. So putting things in context of what was happening at that time is important, which is why I kind of focus on that Khrushchev Kennedy meeting, because that sealed our fate right friggin' there. And there's a lot to explain about his poor performance, and which I'm attempting to do in my blog post today.
Okay. All right. Do you see, it was interesting, I was reading an article today that was out of Task and Purpose. The headline is, John McCain wanted to see one specific part of the new documentary series, The Vietnam War. And so Ken Burns was up in New York City, and he was doing some kind of VIP preview of it. And he said John McCain wanted to see only the North Vietnamese stories. Mm-hmm. He said, show me their stories. I want to see their stories. And he said, our species is bad at learning from events. But if you want to get the most out of this new documentary, you should take the McCain approach and listen to all the perspectives. To me, what I have found most riveting is, and again, I, like you, Tim, I'm a reader, but when you start seeing pictures and video you've never seen in your life, to me, it makes me sit up. You know, and pause it, and whether it's those guys hiking down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, or different views of their training, or different views of the strategic Hamlet program, you know, I've enjoyed that part of it immensely in terms of, and again, whenever you hear veterans speak, and I don't care if they're NVA, I don't care if they're Viet Cong, you know, I always find it interesting, and one of the lead things my nickname for him is Elvis. Obviously, I don't remember his name, but he's an NVA soldier, but he's got blonde hair, okay, which means he's a happening dude.
Yeah, he's a writer. I know who you're talking about,
right? But he says, you know, people talk about who wins and loses wars. He said the truth is nobody wins or loses. There's only destruction. And he's an interesting guy, and I really enjoy hearing their perspective of it, because we know ours. And again, I was, you know, one of the things that I stopped and rewound it and to listen to it again, 58,000 Americans, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marine killed in Vietnam. An estimated 250,000 South Vietnamese soldiers killed in the war. An estimated 1 million Viet Cong and NVA killed in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, I thought, I've never heard those numbers before. Holy shit. 1 million people, that's a lot. And then the other things that I found extremely interesting was, I have to plead ignorance relative to, you know, Ho Chi Minh. You know, what a huge fan he was of the United States. You know, his attempt to engage Woodrow Wilson, and then, you know, later on how certainly he evolves into something different. But it was as much by, let's see. It was as much our fault as anything else that happened. So I found that extremely interesting too. And so anyway,
I mean, yeah, there's pictures. Well, you saw pictures in the first episode of OSS agents with Ho Chi Minh.
Right.
They went in and trained them to fight the Japanese and helped them break the famine. And you know, last night's episode, because you're watching it, you're watching the Diem regime and their brutal suppression of Buddhist minorities and whatnot. And you're thinking to yourself, why the hell were we even there?
Right.
I mean, it's a legitimate question. And that's why I kind of focus on that Khrushchev thing. And you're right. There's a lot there. In the book, every little sidebar that tells a story of an NVA participant or Viet Minh participant is very, very positive. Very positive. And the one thing that they all say about the Americans fighting the Americans is they were touched and they couldn't believe the efforts the Americans made to retrieve their dead and wounded. They said it was absolutely unbelievable and it was a positive thing. But other than that, you know, you've got stories of the Viet Minh soldier who has his girlfriend, they never even kiss, and they spend 5 years fighting, and then they're reunited and live happy. But nothing like that is comparable in the American experience. And I might be a little sensitive, brother, because I've paid attention to Vietnam all my life because of my dad and uncles, and I always felt that they were treated poorly. And I just feel like this is perpetrating that same smear that every guy that fought over there was a sucker. Every lieutenant colonel and above was a psychological lunatic.
But I haven't seen that. I mean, so I don't. I didn't
read the book. Right. Gotta read the, that's just my interpretation from reading the book. And okay. I was going fast. Right.
But yeah. I can in terms of the documentary itself, I haven't taken that away from the documentary. I think everybody that I've seen, you know, portrayed has been portrayed, you know, in an articulate way. One of the things that I won't say it froze me, but I noted it, was President Kennedy's asked a question, I think by Walter Cronkite, while he's being interviewed in Hyannisport, Massachusetts, during the summer. And he says, I know we've lost 47 advisors there. And you think, wow, that number is going to go to 58,000. And Cronkite's questioning the commitment, and Kennedy's talking about the DiEM regime and they'll need to make, you know, the whole Buddhist thing that they were going through and whatnot, that they'll need to make adjustments. If not, then he said, I don't see how they can be sustained. But when he says 47, we suffered 47 casualties there, it's just stunning. And then Kennedy's dead within 5 months after the interview. But it is, he's making a statement, and you think, you know, as events will unfold, you know, 57,950 more will die after this statement. So it's a stunning statement. All right.
It is.
Is there anything else about the documentary that you've noted that you'd share with us?
No, but in watching, though, he covers the press participants, particularly David Hallstrom and Neil Sheehan, who were there from the very beginning. I think that's very well done. I mean, those guys came as proponents. They started getting a little hint early on that things were not right from, of all people, John Paul Vann. Another famous personality from that conflict, and I think that's well done. You know, I just don't feel like the traditional narrative is being challenged enough. And of course, I've read ahead, so I'm a little bit ahead.
Okay, and the traditional narrative would be what?
The soldiers over there were suckers, and
I haven't seen that though.
Yeah, no, I get you. I know. I said
because
I'm
the guys that they portrayed, the guys from Vietnam, are Marlanis and the other Marine's name. The guy who was talking about the OP, what's his name?
John Musgrave.
Musgrave, and then the Army guys that they portrayed are all articulate, bright guys. The CIA guys come across very well, as well. I have yet to look at that and say the sucker narrative. And again, I would tell you that they are no more suckers than we are. I'll tell you a story. I saw an article that came out of Germany the other day, and where this politician was just being blistered for the fact that he said we should be proud of the way our soldiers fought in World War I and World War II. And he was absolutely, and I read it and I thought, well, why wouldn't they be proud? Okay, look, if you want to talk about the SS and you want to talk about criminals, That's one thing, okay? But if you want to talk about German soldiers, you know, who left our country to fight for their country and who fought bravely and proudly on the Eastern Front, who fought bravely and proudly on the Western Front, who fought bravely and proudly in Italy and Africa, we can't talk about that? And the answer is no, you're forbidden. Because everybody's a Nazi. Okay? You weren't just a soldier in the Wehrmacht. You were a Nazi, which is bullshit. But the popular narrative doesn't allow that. And I just remember reading it, and I thought, God, you know, if I went on and spoke about this, you know, I'd be like, McNamara's a neo-Nazi. You know, it's like, no. But let me tell you, what about those of us who fought in Iraq? What did we participate in? And it echoed for me the other day in when Musselman tells me to watch The Road to 9/11. I don't know if you've seen it, but you should.
Right.
Okay, it's on the History Channel. It's 3 episodes or 90 minutes. Put it on your list of things to do. Okay. So, in the final episode, the World Trade Towers get hit, and you have the president with his national security team, and so they're talking about things to do, and Rumsfeld says, we need to attack Iraq. And it's like, all heads slew. What did you say? Like, does he have Tourette's syndrome? What just came out of his mouth?
Mm.
It's like, and I guess the president said, we'll deal with Afghanistan. And then he says to Shelton, and if you can imagine this, Tim, a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Hugh Shelton, right? That's his name, Hugh Shelton.
Right.
He agrees to be interviewed to recount this story. And he said at the end, Rumsfeld looked at him and said, keep planning for Iraq. Now, Iraq has nothing, as we know from history, Iraq had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. Zero. Mm-hmm. And so... So we went and fought for a farce. We've destabilized the entire region with the help of the Obama administration, and we're still trying to unscrew it. We've now got Iraq back to the point where it is going to get its third opportunity to build something again. But nobody has any belief that it will build anything. And I think most people are concluding that until that nation is partitioned and some kind of revenue sharing arrangement is agreed upon, you know, that there won't be peace in that country. And so for those of us who participated in that, are we guilty?
Yeah. What's irritating is the Wehrmacht of World War II is the gold standard for small infantry proficiency. I mean, bar none, the gold standard. They were phenomenal, and as you correctly pointed out, they weren't all party members. I don't think a majority of them were party members. That's just a shame that the Germans can't talk about. Although I ran into some Germans up in Mazar talking about going after the Taliban with their Flächenwaffen, which is what they called the machine guns. These guys were kind of fierce too, man. But obviously a minority in Germany. And getting back to the Vietnam series, that guy last night, the ball-headed guy, the former SF officer from the Army, he's not in the book.
Right.
He's not in the book at all.
Okay.
And so I'm sensitive to that particular charge, and I might be reading too much into it, but I know I've gotten a lot of responses and comments and emails from Vietnam veterans since I started who are seeing it exactly the same way I'm seeing it, and they're pissed.
Interesting.
And so I,
no, it's interesting because as I began to watch it, and I reached out to Bob Nielsen, Vietnam veteran, and asked, would you come on? And he said, I'm going back and forth whether I'm going to watch it or not. And I thought about the great trepidation that Vietnam veterans have as they look at this and they try to decide, should we watch it or not? Is this just going to be one more misrepresentation of the story? And then mm-hmm. for guys like Carl Marlanis, for Musgrave, and other people that participated in this, are we now going to be used in some ill-conceived attempt to portray the Vietnam War that ultimately sells us out again? And so so when you begin to think of that, I mean, this is a huge endeavor for Vietnam veterans, how they're going to be portrayed. Again, this is just me personally. I don't think there's anything that I've seen that reflects poorly on Vietnam veterans. Now, you can take issue with Musgrave's story that it really didn't happen like that. But, you know, maybe that's the panic version of a 19-year-old.
It could be.
Right. And you know, because, you know, when we – well, Tim enlists in the Navy, but the Navy's not the same as the Marine Corps. In terms of what you're exposed to, it could be if you're a SEAL. But for most people, and then when you join as an officer, you're older, right? The difference between a young man at 18, 19, and a young man at 23, 24 – it's a pretty substantial difference in terms of maturity. And so, mm-hmm. you know, and so that's what you're dealing with. They're using him to articulate, you know, the fear. Now, it'll be interesting to see if we see the same kind of statement made by made by Viet Cong and North Vietnamese soldiers about their fear of, you know, whether it be aviation or infantry units or artillery, that when you fought the Americans, you knew that you could be annihilated because units were. And so mm-hmm. it'll be interesting to see if they're portrayed equally. So anyway, other thoughts mm-hmm. on, but again, the trepidation of Vietnam veterans relative to it, the anxiety they feel as this thing bubbles up again. And then Nielsen sent me an email. He said, he said, Hanoi Jane on the front of the Washington Post. He said, unbelievable. I said, yeah, but you know, that's just clickbait. That's just a post, yeah. Right? That's just a post. You know, what can we throw on there that'll get people to look? And certainly, that would do it. So, but again, I say that simply to address the anxiety that whole community of Vietnam veterans, their families, Tim's a kid, who lived with Vietnam throughout their lives. So it's certainly a big event. And any other thoughts about it before I let you go?
No. There are some other parts of that are portrayed in the book that I have significant difficulty believing. Okay. Despite My Lai. And one of the things is when they talk about My Lai in the book, they don't mention the fact that it was the photographer's personal camera, which I think is kind of key. He hid those things and then got them out. I mean, I think that's part of the story, not mentioned. There's allegations of another guy that said his platoon captured a Viet Minh female and spent 2 days raping her before they murdered her. I don't believe that for a second. How the hell does a platoon rape anybody for 2 days? Where were they? I know that what happened in My Lai, it wasn't the only time that that American military misbehaved and raped. I mean, there were probably more, but there sure as hell wasn't that much more. There sure as hell wasn't that much more. And so I find some of that again, and that might be what's triggering me to be so skeptical about.
Well, you know, Tim, I had a Vietnam veteran tell me that stuff happened all the time.
God, I just can't imagine that. I mean, how the hell can that happen all the time? They're not that different than us. How the hell could that have happened all the time? But I hear you. I mean, he's not the only one to make that allegations, you know. Right. And when I talk to like the old man and Uncle Chad, Uncle Chuck to you, and I call him Chuck. But and those guys, they can't. Granted, the field grade officer. Well, I guess Uncle Chad was company grade for both his tours. My dad was a major. I mean, they might be a little bit so far removed. But they weren't that far damn removed. I mean,
let me tell you. But here's one of the things I've learned about Vietnam that I did not know before. And depended on where you were. First of all, it wouldn't happen in the Central Highlands, right? Where mm-hmm. a lot of Marines did a lot of fighting. If you were fighting the NVA, if you were fighting in the mountain battles, okay,
right.
up and down those mountains, if you were fighting up there. There's no women around. Okay.
None at all.
Right.
Yeah, they wouldn't find any.
Right. And so where might this stuff happen? You're fighting the VC, the Viet Cong, in a coastal area, and you're migrating in and out of a firm base. So people have access to drugs. You have poor leadership. You know, so there you have the a toxic cocktail. So and with all those elements involved in it. And so it's interesting. You know, Carl Marlinus made a statement, you know, when I asked him about rape. He goes, look, how would you even, he said, I don't mean to make it so personal, but how would you even get it up? He said, you're on patrol, you got all these other guys, you don't know, you know you're in bad guy country, and now you're going to have sex with somebody? He's like, are you crazy? He said, I don't even, like, understand how it could happen. And so yeah. I said, only on All Marine Radio would you probably hear that statement. But, but again, Vietnam is so different. And here's the other, one of the other things I've learned. And Tim, I think we'll corroborate this. Depending on what year you were there, depending on where you were in the country, experience was were so different, so different. And as Marines, you know, the interviews that we do, that I do, you know, guys tended to be either along the coast protecting things, or they were inland fighting the NVA. Those are kind of the two genres. I don't know anything about the Brown Water Navy. I don't know anything about, you know, the southern Vietnam and the fight down there. And so there was much more centered around the Viet Cong and the cadres there that the NVA would flow into and flow out of. So it's just and again, that to me is the beauty of so far of the documentary, is that you get to see this. You get to see, A, learn something about Vietnam, B, see something about how it was partitioned, C, an outsider goes in there and we're going to train them to fight an insurgency that we don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe some people do, but a lot of people don't. And so to me, you're seeing the disconnects. And then the disconnects are magnified as you go across the Pacific Ocean towards Washington, D.C. Who perceives what? Who has influence with the president? How does that affect policy? Blah, 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 blah. And then, but I think by far the most, the thing that I've found the most interesting is the NVA and the Viet Cong perspective of the battle. And of the fighting and how they did it and what they thought. I find that the most interesting in terms of my own gap of knowledge.
And it is. That blonde-headed guy is real interesting. Typical writer, right?
You know, he's a cool dude, though. I mean, I saw him, I was like, what is that? He looks like a dude I saw in Kinville singing the Beatles and Elvis Presley songs in 1985 in perfect English, but couldn't speak a word of English, right? So they get done playing their set and they get off, and you're like, hey man, that was awesome. And he looks at you like, I don't speak English. Like, what do you mean you don't speak English? You just sang the Beatles and Elvis Presley for like 35 minutes.
it might well have been the same guy for all you know.
It could have been. All right, man. Tell everybody where they find your blog one more time.
Okay, it's freerangeinternational.com.
All right, Tim Lynch. You know what? I have a question for you. This is just kind of my own personal survey. Solve the immigration problem for me.
What you do is you start taxing reparations back home to any of the central any other country, and you rebate that tax to everyone who files a federal income tax.
Okay, hold on. What do we do with the Dreamers?
We tax the hell out of them too. This is what I'm talking. The Dreamers. We're going to have to eat that fiasco as long as we can separate the wheat from the chaff and get the criminal Dreamers the heck out of here. Because you can't tell me that every one of them is a valedictorian.
Right.
I know better than that. All right. If you want to put pressure
hold on. So the Dreamers, we're going to eat that. Okay, parents of Dreamers. What do we do with them?
Tax them.
What?
Tax them.
Hold on. Do they stay? Do we?
They're not going to stay for long. This is, by the way, I didn't make this up. This is what Oklahoma does. Oklahoma puts a 15% tax on all the money being sent back overseas, all of it, right? And when they file, when the citizen files his Oklahoma state income tax, he gets all that money back.
Okay,
so if you don't file your taxes,
so
you don't
the money,
get any money back.
Any money that's wired overseas,
mm-hmm.
So 15% tax,
right?
Okay, all right. So we're going to eat the dreamers, and what's going to happen with their parents?
I think they're going to go to Canada when they start getting taxed like that.
Okay.
I mean, right now you've got a tremendous amount of them going back across the border. What we're trying to do is discourage people coming into the border trying to take advantage of our welfare systems. Well, it's simple. Just tax all the money that comes back. You can build the wall with that money, brother. But not that you need a whole wall. But
okay.
About
and then what are you going to – so and what does the wall ultimately look like?
I think the wall looks at certain segments that are high cross areas. You've got a pretty secure wall that's not going to be easy to tunnel over or climb over. I think the rest of the border you can control with sensors and just police up the people that come across. And I think certain parts of the border, everybody that gets it across there should become a citizen automatically, because that's some hard friggin' humping. Right? Just police them up, put them right in the Marine Corps right now. Boom. But I say that in jest, but you don't need a wall throughout the entire border area. You need it where high cross areas are, which are well known. And then the remote areas you can monitor sporadically, because there's not a lot of people coming through there. They're just not.
Okay, so we're going to secure the border and give meritorious citizenship to people that transit very difficult parts of the border. According to you. Okay.
Yeah,
we're going to the dreamers will stay, and then we're going to tax all cash wire transfers to foreign countries at 15%
mm-hmm.
like Oklahoma does. And their mm-hmm. parents, we're not going to do anything with them. We're just going to tax what they send back, and they'll have no legal status in the country.
I would not say not do anything. I'd say everyone that's picked up for anything outside of a class 2 misdemeanor and above, I think all of them automatically get sent back. But I do believe that now that's the law now. I don't like the amount of criminality that comes with massive immigration. That MS-13 phenomenon that John Ubaldi was talking about is a particularly egregious one. Those guys are hyper-violent.
That's the exception, in my opinion. I mean, that's not the rule. The rule is, the rule tends to be people that come here and work and live in apartments and that's my experience. Now, there might be criminals that, hold on, I should say might be. There is criminals. But the average person sneaks into this country, somehow or other brings their family up here or begins a family here and lives under the radar, hangs out in the parking lot at Home Depot, works for a contractor, works for a landscaper, and tries to make money, and then puts his kids in school and blah, 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 blah. So we're going to do nothing with that person.
Yeah, outside of taxing his remittances, and as you formalize this guy's arrangement as an American, there's got to be sensitivity to the fact that they've jumped the line. There are a lot of people who are spending on average 10 years to gain citizenship here, and we ought not be cutting. You know, those people should have a consideration.
Okay.
Those, you know what I'm saying? And I mean, people that serve in the American military that are have green cards, because I don't. I mean, when I was on recruiting duty, you couldn't put in an illegal alien. That wasn't going to happen. But you could put in green card holders. And I think those guys should get absolutely preferential front-of-the-line privileges for citizenship. But yeah, I mean, like we were saying the other day, we're not going to be deporting millions of people. That's not going to happen.
Okay, so in Lynchland, what's going to happen is they would have no legal status, or would you give them some kind of legal status? Because in McNamara, what I would do is I would have them plead guilty to some violation of the immigration naturalization laws. They would be found guilty and put on probation for 10 years. And if they complete probation successfully, I don't know if I give them a pass to full citizenship. I would give them some kind of unique status, because we're never going to do this again. We've secured the southern border. We can now deal with these people, and we want to get beyond this entire discussion. I don't want to have it anymore, so we're going to deal with it. And I want these people to have some kind of legal status at the if they can get to the end of it. Now, if they can't live life legally in the United States, then they go home. But I want to be done with this.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's an eminently reasonable position. I would just put the tax on the remittances on top of that.
I don't have any issue with that. What about what do you say to the people that say no amnesty?
What does that even mean? I mean, we're way beyond the we're not going to round up every illegal person and march them over the border. It's not a practical solution. What I say to them is, let's talk about realistic solutions in the real world. In a perfect world, we could march them all out, but we're not that's not the kind of country we are. Good God, I sound like Obama. Jesus, I don't mean that. The hell am I saying?
No. When you talk about practical solutions, you know, to this. But again, it all starts with securing the southern border, because we're not doing this again. In 10 years, if there's another 11 million people, we're not doing it again. We will never revisit this issue. And so if you come here and again, you have to be able to show us that you were here in this country yesterday, not as of January 1st, because we're not going to start, we're not going to man the ramparts here and create a stampede from Central America north. Okay. It's as of, January 1st, you had to be here. So, I know a lot of people that, amnesty is a non-starter. Bro, come join us in the 21st century, okay?
it would be nice if that were true, but it wouldn't be nice if that were true, because we wouldn't be America, would we? We're not that harsh of people, as the president said today to the UN. We're a compassionate people. Except for the Rocket Man, we got no compassion for him.
We have no compassion for him. Yeah. All right, man. First of all, I appreciate. And again, the thing, so people know, Tim is he's lived the Vietnam War. He grew up with it. He grew up reading about it. His father, a veteran, and has been on this program. Your dad's not watching it. You know that, right?
No, I know. I told him I check in daily, give him a running update. He didn't even want to hear that.
He really
doesn't want to hear it.
And that's because Vietnam veterans, and in fact, it's interesting, Marlanis, the story he tells, he's told on this program a couple of different times, but he tells the story that he knew another guy, and he and his wife were friends with another family for 12 years. Before the wives spoke, and they found out that they were both Marines in Vietnam, if you can imagine it.
It's unbelievable. If you ever read that book, Stolen Valor, that guy E.G. Burkett, that's what he says is a similar story when he started to join this effort to have a Texas Vietnam War memorial. All these businessmen that he had interacted with in his professional life turned out to be a Vietnam vets. None of them had any idea the other one had ever served. None of them. I mean, it seemed to imply he was talking about dozens. It's just unbelievable to me. Just unbelievable.
And that's how. And so that's not a superficial wound.
Mm-mm. No. God, no. God, no. I mean, are any of our friends or us the least reticent to talk about our time in Afghanistan or Iraq?
No.
I mean, I don't talk about it much, but it's there's no question that. And anybody that knows me knows I was there, you know. I mean, it's not a topic of conversation necessarily, but I'm something I'm proud of, you know. And I wasn't even serving then. I was just a slimy contractor, for Christ's sakes. For you guys, it must be doubly so.
Yeah. No. I mean, you're not embarrassed about it, but as you reflect on hearing, you know, things that Don Rumsfeld said, and you hear things that Robert McNamara said. You're like, wow, is that me? Did I get used the same way? Because the end state of following the end state of following Don Rumsfeld and ignoring the words of Tony Zinni?
Exactly.
Zinni, I don't know what planet they're on, quote, from an interview with Salon Magazine. And and again, disregard Salon Magazine, that's a legitimate quote, right? Lieutenant General Greg Newbold, who resigns from the J-3, because he said this is every and what Newbold knows is Newbold knows the war plan. Newbold knows that Rumsfeld isn't going to execute the war plan. He's going to make his own plan up.
Right.
And Zinni says everything that was predicted to happen by the intelligence assessment, if you took him out and didn't go in there with large numbers of troops to keep the lid on it till you could stand it back up, happened. It happened according to script. And now we destabilized hundreds of thousands. I would say coming close to a million people have been killed in the region. I mean, it's and to think that I was a part of a government, I was part of the instrument a government sent, a duped government was sent to on a fool's errand.
Yeah, but for the guys that went, there was, I mean, where else would you have wanted to be? If the Corps is going to fight, where do you want to be? You know, I wasn't even in the Corps then, and I wanted to be over there. That's how I ended up going over there, was after reading about Paul Kennedy in 2-4. And I'm like, shit, I'm not sitting this out anymore. But so I give us the pass. But in 50 years, Newbold and Zinni are going to be, when the next Ken Burns documentary or whoever that his son ever does it on Iraq, they're going to come out as heroes. They're going to come out as visionaries.
Ken Burns right? Jr.
Yeah, Ken Burns Jr.
His kid, his kid with a bad haircut.
and Rumsfeld's going to come out as he should come out as a horse's ass. It bothers me that McNamara is not getting the same treatment because he was every bit as bad as Rumsfeld, every bit as arrogant, and every bit as wrong. Every bit as wrong, you know. And he gets a pass. And
we'll see. We'll see if he gets a pass. Then there's no way that could be historically accurate. Because it's wrong.
Exactly.
It's wrong.
Exactly.
And it's not like you have to go hunting for Robert Strange McNamara. You don't have to go headhunting to find his and his culpability.
Mm-mm. You cannot. Oh no, it's very it's very easy, very evident. I mean, what is it? McMaster's wrote a book about it, for Christ's sakes, that the general's not standing up to his nonsense.
But don't read it because it's too depressing.
No, I probably won't because I got a bunch of other
no,
to read.
No. You need to read it.
Okay.
But I'm warning you. Take Prozac while you're reading it because honestly, it is one of the most distressing books you'll ever read.
I'll be damned. Yeah.
No, you need to read it to complete your understanding.
Right. No, I know I should. I will, under your advice, put that on the back burner, brother. It's no problem with that whatsoever. But yeah, but that's I guess I'll get off my anti Ken Burns drumming.
If that's built on, it's legitimate if it's built on the your reading of the book, and now you're validating what you're doing, and so.
Yeah. But like I said, that army colonel, that special forces guy, who was pretty impressive last night.
Right.
He's not even in the book, so I mean, it may not be the same. We'll have to see.
Okay. All right. Tim Lynch, Free Range International. You can search for both him and it, and you can find his blog. Tim, have a good day. Thanks.
Thank you, brother. Take care.
All right. There you have it. Yeah. Immigration. We do a lot of stuff. So no. I've smart, well-read friends. Tim's interesting. Again, growing up in a family that was the Vietnam War was a big deal. So right now, the Senate Armed Service Committee, you're going to hear some of it tomorrow. I was watching the House Committee last week interview. naval officers, and they are back on Capitol Hill in front of the Senate Armed Service Committee. And so, so that's going on right now. So you'll hear that part of that tomorrow. It, honestly, the testimony from the House is interesting. But again, when we're talking about the USS Lake Champlain, a United States Navy cruiser running into a 70-foot Korean fishing vessel at noon in fair weather, then come on. When we're talking about the USS Antietam running aground in Tokyo Bay trying to anchor, and then we all know the story of the Fitzgerald and the McCain. That's not an operational problem. That's a discipline problem. And now what they're talking about was turning on their transponder so that they appear on the radars of commercial vessels. The Navy, I don't believe the Navy has ever done that. Now, I don't, in all the tracks that I've seen, you don't see United States naval vessels squawking commercial squawks. Are we that fucked up that we have to do that? And you have to reduce watches to less than 5 hours. Like, you know, and to me, I hear that. It's like, so who do you make stand watch for 5 hours? And do you think they're going to be effective? I mean, that's just bad leadership. You know, I could see maybe 4 hours, and you got to have somebody else with them. When you have one, you have zero. And that's a painful fact of life. All right, we'll see what Mike Musselman's doing. My thanks to Tim Lynch for joining us. More of Almarine Radio on a, and again, let me just put out an advertisement. If you know anybody that would be interested in helping us get All Navy Radio going, I am looking for nominees. So by all means, let me know. There's an email. Mac, have you seen that there's a female that is close to completing IOC? You know, I have seen that. And look, the position all along has been, as long as the standards stay the same, you know, congratulations. Welcome to the club. We've been waiting for you. I don't buy the social argument like, oh, esprit de corps. No, you know, don't change the standard. If she can meet it, then she should be allowed to stay. So, yeah, I've read that. She's, two-thirds of the way through the infantry officer course. So, yeah, all the best of luck to her. Don't change the standard. Don't change the standard. All right, we'll take a break right now. More of Almarine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.